Hey, everybody. Happy Friday. It's Trevin McGee here again with the Scene Stealers podcast. And I'm here with Eric Moline and Trey Hawk. I like how I say like I don't know who the two people I've been doing this thing with.
I think you just inherited the from
80 episodes.
All the
and I'm still.
You've had to cut out of all the episodes. You're now putting
I've
them
actually
back
just
in.
Been absorbing them.
Yeah, exactly.
We got a few movies to talk about today. Actually, just two. We got John Dies at the End and Jack the Giant. Is it Slayer?
Yeah.
Slayer. Okay.
Jack
the Giant Killer.
That's what I thought
it
was.
Based on Jack and the Beanstalk.
Yeah. All right. We'll get to that way later. But first, we want to talk about a couple of things that we have going on, and then we're going to talk about our Oscar party. So, Trey, what's going on at the Draft House?
Well, this week, associated with KCAI Screening Room and Draft House Film School, we're showing Band of Outsiders.
Woohoo!
Mm. At 2 p.m. on Saturday. It's only $5 to get in, so you should absolutely come and see it.
Is this a 35mm print, or is this a digital print?
I'm not sure.
Projection?
All of them are either 35mm print, where we can get a print. Because it's Band of Outsiders, I would be a little skeptical if it was a 35mm print.
It'll probably look better if it's not.
Almost. Because if we don't get a 35mm print, we almost always get a 2K brand new cleaned up digital transfer.
Nice.
And they're able to show it on 4K digital projection, so it's as crisp and as clean and as film grainy and delicious as it can be.
Yeah, we went to Paris, Texas last week, actually, the whole Scene Stealers crew. Yeah.
Including Warren Cantrell.
Yeah, and it looked great. It looked awesome. It was loud as hell.
It was. In fact,
which
Paris.
Was awesome.
Yeah. Paris, Texas was probably just a little too loud.
Got to hear
like
that.
That was at Road Warrior. That was Road Warrior levels, and
you have to hear that Rycooter soundtrack.
Get a little Rycooter, splitting those eardrums. But one of the things that we try and do is show you films that really it's probably impossible that you would see them on the big screen any other place.
Yeah.
So we're actively trying to do that. Last week was Paris, Texas. This week is Band of Outsiders. You probably won't get another chance to see it on the big screen.
Tell us a little bit about Band of Outsiders. We know, but maybe people who are listening to this.
Godard. It's a French New Wave film. It's about a group of three kind of young adults. They two guys and a girl, and the guys basically kind of talk the girl into committing this bank robbery. And it's just sort of the same.
Today we would call them hipsters.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hipster
I mean, French
robbery,
New Wave so. French New Wave are kind of the proto-hipsters.
Yeah.
You know, they were very much too cool for school.
Everything was passé.
Yeah, everything was passé. And the other thing is one of the things that I love about French New Wave and where our hipsters like look to French New Wave as far as their clothing choices,
and their
bathing choices and their choice of unfiltered cigarettes and whatnot. The whole French New Wave movement looked to American films of the 40s and 50s to sort of lead their style. So really, it's why I keep on telling our hipsters, no. Just look at American films in the 20s, and you'll be way far ahead of the curve.
There you go.
Good advice. And Eric, what do you have going on at the Draft House? You've got something coming up.
Yeah, well, the Draft House has let us start a monthly series called Movies That Rock. We will debut this on March 30th, a Saturday night at 10 p.m., which is perfect bar time. And of course, they do serve alcohol at the Draft House.
They do.
Every week, we'll be watching a different rock and roll themed movie, followed by video karaoke, which is basically air guitar karaoke, where you get to choose the song that you want to do. We'll have a playlist of videos, and you get to go up on the stage in front of the movie screen as the video is playing behind you in 5.1 or whatever huge surround sound, and we will have smoke machine and confetti cannons. And yeah, this is going to be a full on rock and roll party afterwards. It'll just get crazy, and the people in the draft house serving unit will continue to serve us alcohol for the rest of the night, so we can go on until the bars close, basically. So Movies That Rock, the film we're showing this time is Air Guitar Nation, the critically acclaimed documentary from 2006 that tells the story of the very first year of the U.S. Air Guitar Championships, which just celebrated its 10th anniversary last year. And this is an amazing story that David Anson from Newsweek said, on a scale of 1 to 7, I give it an 11.
It also kind of inspired you to do one of your new pursuits, or one of your most recent pursuits.
Yeah, I mean, if I would have seen Air Guitar Nation a little bit earlier than 2009, I probably would have been on the air guitar circuit before that. But I saw this film in 2009 and immediately started competing in U.S. air guitar competitions. So this is a very special personal film to me, and it's really, really funny and entertaining. I can't say enough great things about it, and I hope that everybody goes to this event, because if it goes well, we'll, you know, be able to continue to do more. And we've got a lot more rock and roll themed movies, more mainstream ones on the way, but this first one is going with the air guitar.
Yeah, and it's funny because this whole thing kind of it's like right in the middle of the Venn diagram of your interests.
It really is.
Movies, music, and air guitar. It's like right in the center of that.
So. Absolutely. And so after this one, we'll continue to do video karaoke afterwards, but we're looking at films such as maybe Purple Rain.
Mm-hmm.
Such
personal
as
favorite.
School of Rock, maybe Scott Pilgrim.
Yep.
Maybe Almost Famous. Might have to start that one a little earlier.
Yeah, you might have to.
But we'll, you know, we're going to see where it goes from here. So Movies That Rock is going to be fun.
Cool. And while we're talking about Scene Stealers events, We got the privilege to co-host an Oscar party last weekend at the Screenland Armor with our friends from Lost in Reviews. It was a great time. You guys, if you're anyone who's listening, if you came, thanks a lot for coming. We had a blast. It was a ton of fun. And
Screenland Armor needs some help right now.
Yeah, I was about to say they've got a Kickstarter. They've got a Kickstarter up for – they've got to convert to digital. The studios are making them convert to digital. They've got a nice big list of different levels of donation. And it's definitely worth your time to check out. If you just go to Kickstarter.com and search for the just search for Screenland Armor, you'll get the Kickstarter back. It breaks down how you can donate. There's a helpful video. It really is important. Local cinemas are few and far between. And they definitely help give a community their identity. And they're also great because they operate under the radar and can do fun stuff like what they're doing this weekend, where they're showing Goonies and Monster Squad for $5 a pop. You know, they've been doing some really cool, really fun events for a while now. And it's important. So if you like movies, if you like cinema, you don't even have to donate a lot. I think the base donation is like $5.
I don't even want to call it a donation, because essentially it's just paying in advance for your ticket and your popcorn.
Yeah,
yeah, because they do give away part of the prize tiers are tickets, popcorn, mm-hmm. sodas,
35mm film slices. You know, if you really want to donate a lot of money, you can name specific seats in your honor. You can name theaters in your honor. It goes literally anywhere from I think it's $5 all the way up to $20,000. So
you can purchase screenings. Yeah. Basically, you can at certain tiers you buy out a theater, and mm-hmm. you can show whatever movie you want in that theater to 60 of your friends. So you're really just purchasing access to films at varying levels.
Yeah.
So you're not. It's not a donation. You can make a donation, and I think that Screenland Armor is absolutely worth a donation. The flexibility of a mom-and-pop theater, we're losing this flexibility. And what that flexibility is it can understand its communities, it can understand its community's tastes, and it can appeal directly to that particular community. So,
yeah, and it can create some just genuine, unique film experiences, unique memories. I mean, it's they're not actually associated with one another despite the name, but I remember I saw The Thing at the Screenland Crossroads on Halloween, and that just blew my mind.
Yeah.
I'd never gotten to see it in the theater because, you know, I wasn't old enough when it came out, and it's still one of my favorite movie experiences. When we used to get to screen movies at that theater, mm-hmm. seeing Inglourious Basterds there in 35, like an actual 35mm print, not a 2K digital. You know, that's one of the great things that local theaters let you do.
Yeah, and I've seen local independent films at Screenland.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they just, it allows you to do awesome things and to make those sort of cinematic memories that many of us at a certain age have a decent amount of,
right,
but are becoming fewer and fewer with the sort of big box cinema out there, that it suppresses the event of a movie.
Right. So anyway, we'll get off our soapbox on that right now, but we had a great time at the Oscars. What did you guys think of, we'll just talk about the wins and losses and everything. What did you guys think of Seth MacFarlane, though? Since that's what everyone seems to talk about.
Here's the deal with Seth MacFarlane. He was his sexist, misogynist self, and everybody was prepared for that. What I was not prepared for...
And his bigoted self?
Yeah. Was I'm not a fan of Family Guy. I hated Ted. I just think that a lot of his humor is really lazy, and it just plays to stereotypes that people should be burying right now. But that said, I was not prepared for him to be charming. A lot of people have said that he was smarmy.
Yeah.
I thought that actually he had genuine warmth, and it was almost, it wasn't as much as Billy Crystal in the old days, but it was almost like he was with Hollywood instead of, you know, against them. And I think that actually matters in a show like the Oscars, which is celebrating what everybody does. And honestly, if he wasn't consistently funny, at least he was consistently a presence and a good-natured one. So
right.
I'm very mixed on him. I hope that they try something different next year. But if he came back, I wouldn't be horrified. It was funnier than I thought it would be.
Yeah, I agree for the most part. I disagree a little bit about the charming. I think the tonality is where we disagree. I thought that there were some bits that were not as offensive as I was expecting them to be, or a little bit funnier than I was expecting them to be. But you and I actually had a conversation at one point in the night where he will say some slightly or very offensive joke.
Yeah.
And then he'll make this immediately apologetic face.
Yeah.
And I just felt like, man, if you're going to choose to offend us with that joke, just own
commit
it.
To it.
Just
yeah.
own it. Just
but he did own some of
it.
Them where he would. Where
to
he would,
some extent.
After
but
the
even
John
the,
Wilkes Booth one, oh, I got a bunch of Napoleon jokes for you.
Right. Yeah. And that's funny. Yeah. I mean, that's funny in and of itself.
Me and I felt like
that
was rehearsed. I didn't feel like that was an ad lib. I thought
right.
that was
yeah,
the actual
no, that was
joke.
Absolute. That was absolutely rehearsed. He was expecting the groan of the, oh.
Yeah.
And I think that in some ways he's right. How long do we have to wait till we can kind of make fun of our own cultural pain?
That said, the joke about confusing Eddie Murphy with Denzel Washington because all black people look the same.
Right.
Not funny.
And the fact that, and I know that this is consistent with the film, and the fact that he'd make all of...
Sorry.
Oh, the fact that he'd make all of the Jewish jokes through the mouth of Ted... It's like, again, that's him distancing himself
right.
from...
Those were
over.
So lazy and
they're
yeah,
horrible.
They were.
They're terrible.
I'm so sick of that.
They're terrible,
I was mixed on
boring.
Him, too. I was really mixed on him, too.
Yeah.
Except that I think all of the backlash has kind of made me... I liked...
You want to defend him a little bit because...
A little bit.
Yeah.
I am in a position where, like, yeah, all those jokes were really lazy. The, you know, I'll totally admit that, you know, he made jokes like... All you actresses who gave yourself the flu 2 weeks ago, you know, like that was, you know, baseless and tasteless. Meanwhile, he turns around and makes like the joke he makes on Clooney is you date young girls. Ha ha ha.
Yeah.
You know, like I'll totally agree to all of that. I think the opening and I'm really annoyed by how much coverage and how much attention the openings got because I thought it was great.
It was creative.
It was creative. And I thought have Kirk come out. Yeah. And I thought what was great that everyone is going on about that we saw your boobs song and they're taking it out of context because the whole point of that joke was that was what people expected him to do.
Right,
like that
but
was
he
the
did
level.
It anyway.
But he
it's
did,
just a clever
but
way
he
to
did
be
it
himself.
As a comment on what not to do.
Right.
Like
right.
Kirk like Captain Kirk is saying
like,
don't do this.
And it was
but
such and
it,
but
it.
Exactly. Yeah, but it was such a far like it was so like beyond what I think if he had wanted to go that route he would have gone like because it was just you know it was really I feel like it was intentionally lazy and corny and
stupid.
He would
have done that anyway. I think they were just trying to
really.
But I think the fact that I think the fact that it was at least self-referential, like, hey, you shouldn't do this thing that I'm about.
It's like, look what you did. Exactly. Look what you did.
That made it clever instead of just stupid.
Yeah, it's like, I did that. Yeah, I don't know. I thought that was funny.
And
then the Sally Field stuff I thought was really funny. I don't know why that was.
But even the boobs thing.
That's the when he boils down actresses
to just being hot.
It's just like
After
a while,
the premise of the joke though was that he had a schoolboy crush on her because he grew up watching her TV show.
Here's the other thing:
if he'd done that to like Jennifer Lawrence and it just like fawned all over Jennifer Lawrence,
that would have been bad.
And here's one of the things that a lot of the articles have been missing. And I'm fine with the criticism of Seth MacFarlane. Yeah. I think all three of us are absolutely right in the middle. Like, he was better than we expected. He still wasn't great.
Yeah.
But all of this sort of overt criticism of the We Saw Your Boobs and the Sally Field, all of that misses the point that every single cutaway to any of those actresses in the audience during the week was planned.
Yeah.
So Charlize Theron overt reaction of like, oh God, he's talking about my boobs.
Yeah.
Well,
she was implicit in that.
It was pre-recorded because Jennifer Lawrence isn't in the same dress. Like when she fist pumps that we haven't seen him yet, she's in a different dress. Like that was all pre-shot.
Of course, they agreed to it.
It was supposed to be.
It was part of the joke. Now, is it still tasteless? Probably.
Sure.
But can you criticize him because, oh, he's embarrassing these people and reducing Charlize Theron's role in Monster, which is this sort of, you know, gritty, like, gripping performance.
Oh, it gets worse. It gets worse.
Monster's Ball.
No, it gets even worse.
You're talking about the Jodie Foster one.
Right?
Yes. Yeah.
When he said Jodie Foster and The Accused, I was like, oh, I remember that scene. It was a rape.
Right. Of course.
I remember what he just said. He just was rattling them off, and I'm thinking in my head, oh, I know most of these movies.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah. Of course. Well, I mean, well, so it is tasteless.
There are
legitimate criticisms.
In at least three of the movies he references, there's rape in them. Monster.
Really?
Yeah, remember in Monster when Charlize Theron gets raped tire iron, and then Boys Don't Cry. I mean, come on.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I mean, so there are legitimate
criticisms. I'm not defending that. That's lazy and shitty. And I think it goes back to what we're saying. Like, the writing needed to be tighter, and he just went the lazy route. But I'm saying that the mechanic of him saying, you thought I was going to do this, and I'm not going to do this, but I liked that it was that clever, and then that it countered every one of those sort of tasteless things with like an old Hollywood bit.
Singing and dancing routines.
Yeah. You know, I liked that it went back and forth. That was the only real big thing we got. We, you know, like the tiebreaker on our Oscar ballot is when it's going to end. They cut it off for us at exactly 11 o'clock, so we didn't get to see it. But I watched the last bit on Hulu because you can watch all three parts on Hulu, and we got spared like a pretty groan worthy conclusion because it's him and Christian Chenoweth singing another big band jazzy song called "Here's to the Losers," and they just rattle off everybody who's lost, and it needed to be over. I think and you can tell he's not into it either. He's just like, we're.
Ending with the best picture is really the way to go.
People. Yeah, pretty much. Just sum it up.
That's
and say,
one lesson learned, probably.
Say thanks and goodbye, especially when you have the First Lady read the winner live from the White House. You're not going to top that. Just go ahead and cut to credits and get out of there.
That was weird, by the
way.
It was really weird.
Is Jack Nicholson not enough?
No.
Do we need Michelle Obama?
Yeah.
What did they cut
I liked
to
her
him?
Plea for the arts, though. So.
That was great. What did they cut to Nicholson for where he just looked super confused and then just and stared at somebody?
No, because he... earlier in the broadcast.
I can't remember who it was for.
It was some joke that Seth MacFarlane told, and they cut to Jack Nicholson, and then all of a sudden he looked. It was like he had been caught on the kiss cam.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like, oh, I'm on the TV? Yeah. And he just looks around,
Well, we talked about that longer than I thought we would, so let's get into some movies now.
Let's do Biggest Surprise real quick.
Biggest Surprise, go for it.
Yeah, biggest Surprise for...
Oh, for all of us?
Yeah.
I'll start Brave winning. Brave winning animated was bonkers to me.
Wow.
Pixar mounted a very good campaign because they brought the director who was fired and the director who finished the movie together, and they were both campaigning for the movie this season.
Yeah.
And that was kind of a big deal because Brave is about mainly about its female characters, and so the first woman to win in that category was the woman Brenda Chapman, who was fired from that film, but she wins the Oscar anyway. Yeah. So it may be the first time that somebody fired from a film wins the Oscar, but that was a little tidbit of that movie that I didn't quite get until after the win, and I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why that happened. That, and I think Wreck-It Ralph being a video game movie just didn't appeal to the older voters. What about you, biggest surprise for you?
Biggest surprise was Tarantino winning for screenplay. Exciting surprise. I kind of feel like he's sort of relegated to that category.
Yeah.
He's never going to win. I think you only have so many really incredible films in you, mm-hmm. and I think he's already made his couple.
Brutal. But I agree it's not one of his best, and it might even be his worst. What's interesting is that it followed the Academy rule of giving somebody the Oscar the year after that they deserved it.
Right. Yeah,
he should have gotten it for Inglourious Basterds, but instead he gets it for Django Unchained, which we all agree is uneven. Can I say lugubrious?
Yeah.
Screenplay.
Sure.
For me, I thought that was one of the bigger surprises of the night too. But I actually picked it because when I was looking at my ballot, I knew they weren't going to give it to Zero Dark Thirty.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I figured, well, they're not going to give it to Amour, even though I want it to happen. And so he was really the only one left. I think that really helped him.
Yeah, it did.
If there was stronger competition, I don't think he would have won. For instance, if Kushner was nominated for Lincoln in the same category, it would have gone to Kushner.
I think so, too.
So that was just kind of luck. And I think a lot of people don't understand that when people win Oscars, a lot of the time it's because who they were nominated against.
Oh, of course.
Yes. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
There's so many dumb things that factor into it. Unions and everything. Like, yeah, all kinds of things factor into who gets voted for why.
Yeah.
So what was your surprise, Eric?
My biggest surprise was, Christoph Waltz was not a surprise. I picked two upsets and neither of them happened. So I guess you could say that favorites and Waltz upsetting Jones was kind of a surprise. But for me, Lincoln winning production design.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody picked that. Like, where the hell did that come from?
Yeah.
I guess they do often pick historical pieces. But I think it just shows that they didn't love Anna Karenina. And the fact that they just gave it costume design, which was the obvious one, and not production design, which is something that helped was essential to the story, is just insane. But it just proves that they didn't like the movie that much.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was weird. It was almost like they were like, well, we're giving Daniel Day-Lewis one, and we've got to give Lincoln something else. Since they went with Argo instead of Kushner, I guess they decided, well, we'll do it in production design.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, it was all in all. I mean, it kind of broke down the way I thought it would. I couldn't. My only surprise was that Life of Pi got cinematography.
It wasn't a surprise.
I mean, it's a gorgeous movie, but it's all on blue screens and sound stages.
Yeah, but we had talked about that. It's the Dazzle one. It's the one that has some live actions. You know, a small amount of live action, like on screen, like practical stuff, and then a ton of CG stuff and integrated.
Yeah, I know, but you know, when you can manipulate light in a computer.
Yeah,
and that's one of the.
Yeah, I get it.
It's one of the fundamentals of cinematography. I feel.
I think
that's
it just shows that
have an asterisk next to it.
I think it just shows that Hollywood is really not paying attention to the craftsmen, in particular, that are nominated in their stories. For Roger Deakins to have lost 10 Oscars at this point.
Oh, I know.
That means that they were just looking at the movie and picking which one looked the best.
How many did Conrad Hall win? Because I always compare him and Deakins.
He won for American Beauty.
I know he won for American Beauty, and was that it?
Mm-hmm.
Did he not win one for
Road to Perdition? I don't think so.
No, or In Cold Blood?
Hold it, was he?
he was Road to Perdition.
No, did it? Was he?
I think so. Yeah, he was, and he won it. Road to Perdition was his last one. I'm pretty sure he won it.
No, I think he. Well, we're gonna have to look.
Okay,
we
won't mess with that anyway.
Died right around that.
Yeah, once we get into the cinematography awards, it's like not immediately.
All right.
Call.
Obviously, we're stretching it out because the two movies we have to talk about aren't So great. But we'll go ahead and start with
this coming from the person who didn't see either of the two movies.
I have gotten feedback already from both of you, and it's not good.
Have you?
From you, definitely.
Did I say something?
Yeah, you did. Let's talk about John Dies at the End, though.
Okay. All right. So this is a film.
Opening this weekend in Kansas City.
Yep.
We should mention.
All right.
Yeah.
So today it's opening in Kansas City. Based on the online book, John Dies at the End by David Wong, who was one of the editors of Cracked Magazine, Cracked.com. So he wasn't, obviously, it wasn't an editor of the print magazine Cracked. because he actually talked about the dissonance between Cracked.com and the print version when he became the editor of Cracked.com. Anyway, this film, I could talk a little bit about the plot, and it's basically these two kind of post-college age guys, sort of just typical slackers, got an apartment, crash on the sofa all the time, we're out at a party. And these two guys get approached by this crazy Jamaican guy who can do magic tricks. And Dave, who the story is actually about, his buddy John is a supporting character. But Dave is skeptical of this guy's powers, magical powers, and starts to kind of push him and sort of tease him. And finally, this Jamaican guy really, like, kind of lays it out, goes, all right, well, I'll tell you the dream you had last night and what it means. And so he just sort of lays Dave flat, and Dave is a little bit freaked out. But what it all boils down to is that this Jamaican has this substance, this black substance that they refer to as soy sauce, that when ingested in whatever form, either as a drug, sometimes it looks like it's popped as pills, sometimes it's injected through needles, sometimes it forcefully invades your body. But when ingested, allows you to move between, I guess, dimensions is a way, it would be the way to refer to it as.
And it turns into arachnid bug things. I mean, the thing that comes in and out of people is usually in bug form.
Sure. The soy sauce, sometimes it looks like a spiky ball, sometimes it looks like a fly, sometimes it looks like different things. And once you can go between dimensions, you see other things that have accidentally come to our dimension, which otherwise you wouldn't see and wouldn't be able to harm you. Like, once you have ingested the soy sauce, those things that would be invisible now can hurt you. So that there's a back and, you know, there's kind of this bizarre back and forth. The story itself is okay. And the film itself is absolutely constructed in such a way as to become sort of a cult phenom. Where it will be hugely appealing to a very small niche audience. And it's at times very clever, really charming, totally approachable for being an absolutely no-budget B-movie, nutsoid cult film. The narrative is not perfect. It's broken and kind of oddly structured and most of the time doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
But you know what? When it starts making sense, that's when the movie starts to suck.
Kind of. Yeah. Yeah. When they over-explain it, yeah. that's when it's just kind of crazy nuts.
Yeah.
That it's pretty fun and you're just dealing with. And I think the key to it working is the character of Dave being this total, like, straight everyman character. Just reacting to all of this
very dryly
crazy stuff going on, totally, yeah, in a very dry form.
We should talk about the director.
All right, Coscarelli, John Coscarelli.
Don
Coscarelli, that's right. So I really was excited about this film because Coscarelli has been one of my guilty pleasures for years. He is... if Sam Raimi had just continued making Evil Dead films, that would be a Coscarelli, you know, corollary 10 years later. Coscarelli made the original made all of the Phantasm sequels. So he did Phantasm in, I think it was 77. He did Beastmaster in the early 80s. He did all the Beastmaster sequels, even the made-for-TV one.
Jesus.
What else was he doing?
He did Bubba Hotep.
Yeah.
And now he's done John Dies at the end. So having said that sort of list of films, if those are the types of films that when you hear them, you kind of perk up, which I feel like Coscarelli is unapologetically entrenched in sort of this low-budget B-movie culture. And because of that, because it never feels like he's gunning for that, for his shot, that big budget shot.
There's something authentic about it.
Exactly. Yeah. And that has a sort of passion and a charm and an energy.
We should mention that Paul Giamatti is in this film, and he was one of the producers.
He was the executive producer. Yeah. He was the reason why this probably got any funding at all. It probably was produced through his production company, or associated with. But Giamatti is the EP. He was the one that secured them funds. So the fact that Coscarelli is just what he is, and he makes the type of films that he makes, there's just kind of a joy and a passion for this level of filmmaking. It's exactly the type of film that blows up at Fantastic Fest and at Comic-Cons and you know, it will have a huge niche following. It absolutely is not going to play to a wide audience. And Coscarelli's fine with that, and everybody involved in the movie probably already knew that.
But you know what? I have to say, again, I got to go back to the ending where it's like, if he was going to make a niche movie that was so weird that didn't have any potential, then why did it turn into a very straightforward kind of a over-explained action film at the end? It really did fall apart, and after a while I was like, well, all the fun stuff that kept me paying attention now has me looking at my phone.
Well, you know? And that's one of the while it's crazy, it has this element of mystery, like what's going on.
And then as soon as there's a mission and as soon as you have some
understanding of like, oh, this is what the soy sauce is, and these are how these people, these different characters who were just mysterious side characters.
They should have wrapped it up quicker and maybe done some of that explanation in flashback and made it more mysterious somehow. But
that's true. And I wouldn't say that it falls apart. It just loses its steam and becomes a little bit boring at the end. It doesn't totally fall apart. It didn't for me.
Just kind of ends on a sigh.
Yeah, it does. It just kind of goes, all right, okay, that's what we've done. I will say that, you know, for fans of character actors, Clancy Brown is in this.
I love Clancy Brown.
Not enough.
Not enough. I agree. Not enough. But when he's there, it's pretty fun when he's around. And he actually does this one, like, where he fires off a round of a gun and then, like, twirls it and then flips it inside and holsters it in probably one of the coolest ways I've ever seen. And I was just happy that old-ass Clancy Brown gets to do that. So, you know, when you were if you're looking for more Clancy Brown, if Starship Troopers and Shawshank Redemption don't give you enough Clancy Brown, you've got another Clancy Brown outlet in John Dies at the End.
Sweet.
Rockfist ratings, both of you.
I'm giving it a minor Rockfist up. I think it's fun. I think it's charming. I think it makes no pretenses to be anything other than what it is.
Yep, I agree. Minor Rockfist up.
All right, two minor ups. Eric.
Yes.
How was Jack?
Jack the Giant Slayer. Nabber.
Directed by Bryan Singer, by the way. Directed by one of your favorite directors, who I don't think has made a single good movie since Usual Suspects, and I'll stick by that.
I would agree
that
with that.
That is the dumbest thing I've heard.
I think he is absolutely.
Oh, really?
It's an early morning, but that is the dumbest thing I've heard all day.
He made
X-Men, which was good, and X2, which is the second best superhero movie.
It really isn't. I know that you like to cling to that 10 years later,
no,
but it's not.
It's a fantastic
movie. No, it's not.
Yes,
I think Superman is just proving his stripes now.
Also, Superman Returns, underrated.
Superman Returns sucks.
It does not suck.
100% sucks.
Kevin Spacey's subplot and his way of Lex Luthor taking over the Earth was dumb. But super everything dumb. Else about that movie – well, okay. Kate Bosworth, not a great
also
Lois
dumb.
Lane. But everything else about that movie –
Superman
he was the only
coma.
Guy to get Superman.
Superman
like,
in a coma.
Superman
in
a
Christ,
coma.
Christ coma, carry him, trying to put an IV in his – no. No, you don't
you're
get a free
gonna
pass.
You're either going to kill Superman – or you're not going to kill Superman. If you put him in a coma, it's time to get popcorn.
Yeah.
Terrible.
You're not going to win this fight, my friend. I think
well, you know
his
what?
Two X-Men
I haven't
movies
seen
are
it
shit.
Recently enough to remember the coma. So I guess
right.
I'm not even going to talk
yeah,
about
it. You're blocking
specific.
It out like a car wreck.
No. I'm not as concerned about the rules of stupid superhero
No, I don't
bullshit.
Care about the rules. I'm talking about
I don't either.
How
– You're also talking to an anti-fan, anti-Comic-Con person.
All right. Bryan Singer's
Superman
terrible.
Returns is the first Superman movie that made me feel like this guy has godlike powers.
Right, and it was supposed
and
to.
And
it was
really
which
awesome.
What
a kind of weird and creepy.
Yeah, I will say that when he's Superman, which is not often enough, some pretty great stuff happens on screen. But
I like
he's
the
not
brooding
Superman
quality
enough.
Of it.
All right.
Whatever.
We don't have time to get into this. Bryan Singer sucks. Now tell me about Jack the Giant Slayer.
You know, that is like the worst setup ever
that
because
really
he knows where this is going.
Yeah.
And so he's yeah. just using it to talk about how bad Bryan Singer yeah. is because then the guy who likes Bryan Singer is going to have to shit all over this movie.
No,
which
I
is
understand.
Me,
it's
and
a
this
trick.
Movie, which deserves to be shit on. Here's the thing.
Maybe he'll redeem himself with Days of Future Past. You know about that?
What, the new X-Men film?
Yeah, that's
going to
bring
yeah.
all the old cast and
yeah,
all the new
I
cast
hope he
together.
Does.
So maybe he'll totally
I hope he
redeem
does.
Himself.
I think he did this for the money. Oh. I think he did Jack the Giant Slayer.
Really?
For the
you
money
think
because,
you think he did Jack
well,
the Giant?
Well, here's the thing. He did Valkyrie, which
right.
was
wasn't Christopher McQuarrie's script. It wasn't great.
Yeah, it was middling at best, and it showed you know some of his weaknesses. And as far as plotting and thriller elements go, you know it worked enough there, but it was just kind of dumb.
Yeah.
And now we have Jack the Giant Slayer, which if you've seen. Any number of the stupid fairy tale movies that mm-hmm. have been coming out in the last couple of years since the CGI explosion has made Hollywood decide
is this like
that they
Twilight
have to raid.
Fallout? Is that what this is?
No, I think
what?
It's just that
why
they have to raid
this?
The cupboards of every single known entity
yeah.
known to man. And so
I think it's just buying time until they can rehash the same comic book fair that they've been rehashing.
Well, yeah. No, I mean, they're already doing that. I'm just saying that now they're going into fairy tales and every – if there's yeah. board games, if there's any sort of an entity that they think will get people – a familiar entity to get them into the theater.
I don't know. I saw Battleship
is.
And I thought it was awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, when do we get Hungry Hippos?
We are getting Game of Life. That actually is happening. And you want to know
with Zoe Deschanel?
No, you know who's directing it?
Who?
Ridley Scott.
Nice.
Yeah.
No, he's doing Monopoly, isn't he?
Oh, Ridley yeah. Scott anyway. From Beyond the Grave.
Anyway, he's
no,
not
that's
Tony
no.
Scott.
Tony
sorry,
Scott.
Hang it.
So there's this movie called Jack the Giant Slayer.
Okay. Let's,
and I guess the joke's on everybody who listened this long to the podcast because I always say that the hardest thing to do is to when you're reviewing films. Is to review mediocre movies. When you hate a movie,
it's
really,
really
easy to review, and it's kind of fun to dig into why you don't like it. And same with, as when you're passionate about something else. Jack mm-hmm. the Giant Slayer is so devoid of personality in every way possible that it is the blueprint for mediocrity. It's not... Okay.
Ewan McGregor's in this thing too, isn't he?
Ewan McGregor is in this. Ian McShane is in this.
Oh, McShane. Quit slumming McShane.
Stanley Tucci shows more personality than anybody in a couple scenes
giant.
In this film.
Is
Nicholas,
he a giant?
What?
Tucci,
no.
is he a giant?
No, he's the bad guy. Nicholas Holt, who was so good in Warm Bodies
yeah.
And barely said anything, barely says anything in this movie and is not so good. There really isn't anything going on. Eddie Marsan is in this film.
All you Eddie Marsan fans out there.
It reimagines Jack and the Beanstalk story as an excuse to have a love affair between a farm boy and a princess,
mm-hmm.
which you know right from the beginning exactly how that's going to end,
mm-hmm.
and an excuse to have giants invade a castle. That's it. That's the entire reason that this movie exists. It's almost as if... The visual effects artists who were shooed off the stage the other night at the Oscars while they were trying to talk about the VFX industry going in the toilet right now after winning their Oscar for Life of Pi, it's almost as if this movie exists to prove their point. Because without them, there would be no film.
Right.
I will even go so far as to say, I don't know how you can say this is a Bryan Singer movie, because it's a scene where these actors kind of go through their motions with a script that absolutely, just like Witch Hunters, Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters, needs somebody to polish it up and spruce it up and make it funny, because it's not. The biggest laughs in the film are giants farting and picking their nose. I'm not kidding. Although Stanley Tucci has a couple great moments.
Where he picks his nose and farts at the same time.
No, because he's Stanley Tucci, and he's doing something kind of interesting with his role, right?
Sure.
What's not interesting is that he has bad teeth. And that's another thing that everybody seems to laugh at. But really, this movie doesn't have a personality at all. And it's just a series of events where the actors, you know, act out the most boring, cliched parts of the story that they can to get their courage up to go fight. And everything goes down the way it's supposed to. And there's no spark. There's nothing in it except for the CGI, which is quite good.
Yeah.
Besides the fire effects, which nobody has figured out how to do yet, apparently.
Yeah, what does it take?
Everything else in this film looks great. The close-ups of the giant's faces and everything.
Did you see it in 3D?
I did see it in 3D, and there is absolutely no point to it.
Yeah.
So please save your money. There's two spots in 3D where something jumps out at you, but the depth is not impressive. There's no immersion into the world. It's just a ticket buy.
Of all the movies we've had to see in 3D,
there's been very.
I was going to say, are there probably like three at this point that we can think of?
I wouldn't go lower than that. I think Avatar has to be seen in 3D.
Avatar, Coraline, and then maybe Life of Pi.
I thought Life of Pi was great in 3D.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, I think Coraline is beautiful in 3D, but
Hugo's one of my favorite 3D movies.
I think Coraline is just beautiful. Hugo, I did not need to see it in the 3D. I saw it in 2D. I thought it was fine in 2D.
I saw it in 3D three times and loved it every
time. The only two that I think are Pina and Cave of Forgotten Dreams.
So it's a textbook example of mediocrity in every way.
Yeah.
Does that mean it's the Swiss fist?
No, it's not. It's a minor rock fist down. I can't recommend it. Yeah. I mean, there's no reason to sit through it again, and I wouldn't want to put anybody through it because there are...
Is there anything interesting about it?
Like, no. Nothing.
Soundtrack.
Besides the CGI. Yeah. No.
Nothing.
No, because that's the thing, is when you have a serviceable Hollywood movie, it does what it's supposed to do, and you feel like you've been on a roller coaster, and at the end, you feel good about it.
Right.
Movie. Wow. This movie doesn't even do that. So that means that it's below average.
Okay.
It's a minor rock fist down. It's
I really can't wait. In every way. I really can't wait until Zack Snyder comes and shows Bryan Singer how Superman's done.
Oh my
done.
God, I'm going to kill you. That's the preview before Jack the Giant. Woo! Started,
the new one? Is it a brand new one?
3D Man of Steel.
Yeah, that's the only thing that saves Bryan Singer is the fact that Zack Snyder exists and can ruin everything worse. Yeah. So be glad.
Early buzz on Superman's good. Early screenings have come back pretty positive. But
apologies to Warren Cantrell for not being able to do a podcast when he was in town because we didn't have much to talk about.
Yeah.
But I'm starting to think that maybe next year, if he comes in town, or sometime soon, we can do a Superman Returns podcast. Because I need to see it again and remember why I liked it so much. It's been a long... I haven't seen it since the theater.
Oh, well...
But I am...
It does not age well, my friend, because I've seen it more recent than that.
I have, too.
I'm just saying, it's a movie that everybody shits on, and I still think it's got some really great stuff.
The funny thing is not... Like, I was in the minority when walking out of the theater. I was just like, that was garbage.
I saw it twice in the theater.
Right. A lot of people did. And for the first year afterwards, I was very much in the minority as far as railing against it.
There you go.
Yeah.
Trey Hawk ahead of the curve, as always.
Hating things before everyone else hates them. Trey Hawk.
We're going off the rails pretty hard, but so we're going to go. But just to recap, we've got two minor rock fists up for John Dies at the End. And a minor rock fist down for Jack the Giant Slayer. So there you go. There are your Friday movies. We'll be back next week with some more. And until then, have a good one.